It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 484. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. This show is brought to you in part by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers, unattended and on-demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking on the link on my website at miketechshow.com. Use the promo code MikeTechShow. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. Can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Facebook. And please like the Mike Tech Show page. And that's at Facebook.com/MikeNationNet. You can check out the wiki, and that's at mtswiki.com. I got another jam-packed show, and I promised I would get to all of the email, and I'm going to do my best to cover everything, so let's not waste any time and get right to it. This is from Nancy, and it's in response to the CryptoLocker ransomware, and this is a very good question. I know CryptoLocker encrypts your hard drive. Well, it doesn't encrypt your hard drive. It encrypts the files on the hard drive and only your data files, only certain files. But what effect would it have on an already encrypted hard drive? I'm just learning about encryption methods, and I haven't heard this answer yet. I'm about a month behind on my podcast listening, so by the time I hear you take it on, I may have the answer from elsewhere. Love the show, and thanks for all the time and effort you put into it. I deal with whole drive encryption for a lot of the financial advisors I support and different other vertical markets and industries where they require that security. So let's think about this. If I have a whole drive that's encrypted, once I boot up and I enter that encryption password, I'm now in what's operating like a normal hard drive because I've unlocked it. So your data on that encrypted drive is vulnerable while you're using the operating system and while it's in that state of unencrypted. The reason we have whole drive encryptions is for when you're not on the system. So this way, if it's a laptop and you lose it, nobody's getting into that system. If they take that drive out and they try whatever they want to try, whatever utility they try, they're not getting in unless they have the software and password for what encrypted your hard drive. And you really need the operating system as part of this combination. So if they try to hack in, unless they have your encryption password, they're not getting in. But while the system is being used by you, and let's say you open that infected email that has the CryptoLocker infection, it will encrypt files on the encrypted hard drive. So just having your whole hard drive encrypted does not protect you. What it does protect you, if the system is off, well, if it's off, it can't encrypt it anyway, but it's really to protect your data from someone compromising it by stealing your computer, if you lose your computer, but it has to be off. Remember, if you have an encrypted hard drive and you've logged in, and you walk away from your computer and it's wide open, well, just because it's encrypted, someone can come by and take data off it and do whatever they want. It's not for those moments. It's for the moments when you're not at your system, you've already maybe set your screensaver password, or you have shut your machine off, and now nobody can get to the data without your encrypted password. I hope that explains that. Great question, Nancy. Another comment on CryptoLocker, and this is from Craig. I had a theory after listening to your last couple of shows, 481 and 42, regarding CryptoLocker. The theory I have is, can a fully encrypted hard drive on a non-infected computer prevent CryptoLocker from actually getting into the user's files and re-encrypting them? Since point of data encryption is to prevent unauthorized access, but if you think about how I just explained it, you know, and add a level of security, one would think that even CryptoLocker could not penetrate that safeguard. No, using your computer, you've unlocked the encryption of the hard drive, and it's now a normal hard drive while you're using it. There are so few computers in the world have encryption on their hard drives that this procedure might have been overlooked as a potential safety net for users. Unfortunately, it's not. Again, this is only a theory and can already be dead in the water. I don't have access to a non-production computer to test my theory out. However, though, one of your listeners might be up to the challenge to see if this works. Craig, thank you so much. If anybody has any other insight into this to add maybe a better explanation than the way I've tried to simplify looking at this, because I deal with full encryption drives. And let me tell you, I've had a clean, heavily infected systems. And this is why I know you're not protected. They get infected. Whole hard drive encrypted systems get infections. I've had a clean, all kinds of horrible infections. Now, I have not had to clean CryptoLocker just because it hasn't happened yet to any of my clients that have hard drive encryption. But that doesn't mean it can't. It just hasn't happened to them. But I believe it can, and I believe you can encrypt files on a hard drive that's already whole drive encrypted. Make sure that just because you may have your whole system whole drive encrypted, you still need malware, you still need antivirus, you still need crypto prevent to change the security policies of the local system. You need all those things. You're not protected. This is from Josh, and this is about the Windows 8 license key. I was listening to your most recent podcast, 482, and heard a listener that sent an email about finding a Windows 8 license key. I myself work in an IT repair shop in England, and I'm always getting people with faulty hard drives and having to reinstall Windows 8. Unlike Windows 7, where there's a sticker normally on the bottom of laptops or on the back of the desktop with the full license key, with Windows 8, they put a sticker about the same size as an Intel sticker, but with the Windows 8 logo and no license key. Now, surprisingly, if there is no license key on the machine, check the BIOS. I've had this multiple times in the past, and a quick look at the BIOS reveals the full license Windows 8 license key. Here's a little blog post I found that talks about retrieving the license key. I hope this answered your questions. Absolutely love listening to your podcast, Mike, while I'm doing repairs. Keep up the great work. Thank you. That is the perfect answer that we're looking for. I have not been dealing with retail Windows 8 machines. All of my corporate clients, all of my small businesses, I'm still providing Windows 7 Pro or Windows 7 Ultimate, where the license keys conveniently on the side. I've installed Windows 8 for myself, but that was a TechNet download. So I had the key and I had the media, and I didn't purchase a brand new Windows 8 system. Just keep that in mind. And Josh, thank you very much for that answer. This is from Terry, and she says, you read my email about not having a Windows 8 key sticker on my Asus Ultrabook. I purchased a laptop from a Microsoft store. I guess that if I did not have a system image to restore from, that Microsoft would have all my info. I have scanned my receipt and I have not saved on SkyDrive, so it's not an issue for me. I just wonder if I'll eventually come across a client who had to restore media and no product key on Windows 8 computer. Well, now we know, look in the BIOS. Jason, you had a listener on a previous show that was asking about activating Windows 8 with no product key. On name brand computers, Windows 8 will activate when you install it. Instead of a product key, it activates off the BIOS UEFI somehow. I've reinstalled Windows 8 multiple times, even after replacing the hard drive, and had no problems activating it. However, OEM and retail versions like you buy from Amazon, Newegg, or Best Buy do require product key, and this is usually provided on a sticker, just like Windows 7. Now, this is about Windows 8.1 problems from Tim. Just another observation for Windows 8.1 upgrade, an email from my friend Tony. So today, I'm seeing the exact same thing that made me revert from 8.1 back to 8.0 earlier. No access to some advanced networking features. You can't change a Wi-Fi password. You can't view the configuration properties of any network connection, specifically wireless. There's nothing in Control Panel. You can't right-click on any existing connection and view its configuration. This really sucks. And now, to top everything, I've discovered that Windows 8.1 upgrade wipes out all of the 8.0 restore points. When Microsoft wants to move you forward, it seems there is no turning back. So, I'm currently trying to go to an earlier 8.1 restore point as I'm writing this to see if it restores wireless configuration functionality. But after that, I'm seriously going to take steps to do another factory restore without 8.1. There is nothing 8.1 offers that is so good to offset the instability, missing functionality, and software incompatibility problems I'm seeing. I strongly do not recommend 8.1. The risks far outweigh any minor benefits I'm seeing. Tony. Now, I haven't had the drastic reaction Tony has. My biggest problem is the startup time has tripled. Actually, my startup time tripled going from Windows 8 to Windows 8.1. If you're on the fence and you're sitting with Windows 8.0, my recommendation is do not upgrade to 8.1 right now. Hold firm. Stay with 8.0 and don't upgrade to 8.1. That's my position. If you are a Windows 7 user, maybe you're using Windows 7 Home Premium or Windows 7 Pro, and you're thinking of upgrading to Windows 8, why? Unless you have a touchscreen and you want to have the benefits of that Metro interface with a touchscreen, I don't see any benefit. It does run faster. And you know, when I reported back when I first installed Windows 8 on a laptop and it was an SSD drive, I booted in 10 seconds. I used the classic shell that suppresses the Metro interface from starting and puts my start menu back, and I'm happy, and everything was great. Things started going haywire when I upgraded to 8.1, just like I'm reading. Now, I think I have some other emails here that's going to praise 8.1. It depends on your situation. It depends on the hardware you have, but right now, unless you're a tech or a geek that you just want to experience it, I would make a full system image of your Windows 8 system. Put that aside. Upgrade. And see if things go good. Things are good, or do things get worse? And if things get bad and ugly, then just restore your Windows 8 setup. That's only if you just can't help yourself and you want to experience 8.1, like I did. And I didn't have a system image. But I'm fortunate that I have the media for my TechNet Windows 8. And I'm giving strong consideration of reverting back to Windows 8 and getting rid of 8.1. I'm actually thinking of that on my production laptop. This is from William. I see there is a Mike Tech show tonight, and I was hoping you could touch on Windows 8.1. This is from today, obviously. A short while back, you mentioned you wouldn't recommend upgrading to Windows 8.1 at that time. You said that it slowed your startup. Is that still your opinion? Yes, it is. I'd like to know if or when to move to 8.1. And this is from Bart. Bart, you now have the answer. And my advice is do not upgrade. As a matter of fact, I'd wait till Windows 9 comes out because I believe it's going to put the start menu back the way we like it. So seems like Microsoft has this problem with even numbered operating systems. We seem to have to go to every other one. XP, we skip Vista, go to 7. Let's skip 8, go to 9. Every other one seems to work. That's why if you're already with Windows 7 and you've been thinking of upgrading, there's no reason. Now, if you get a new computer, you might not have a choice. With all the help from the past shows that we talked about Windows 7-izing your system, using things like the classic shell to put the start menu back in the position where you have to get a new computer and your only choice is it comes with 8.1, it will probably run fine. Hopefully it's been tuned by the manufacturer and it's working great. I've had bad luck with 8.1. This is from Terry. I told my coworker about my Ultrabook with no certificate of authentication, and he went to Office Max and looked at laptops at the Windows 8 and the Windows 8 laptops did not have COAs. I emailed Terry and let him know that, I don't know if it's a he or a she. I let him know that you can look in the BIOS and get the license key. This is from Dave. And this is interesting. He wrote in and said, I've discovered on some later model laptops that the COA for Windows 8 is under the battery. Or actually, not just Windows 8, but Windows 7 too. And I've noticed that. If you don't have your key, remove the battery. And yes, I've seen that with some models. Under the battery is the little certificate of authenticity. This is from Brandon. Regarding gaming consoles, Xbox has been ahead of PlayStation in market share for years. This is in regards to my comments last week on the PS4. PlayStation finally beat Xbox out in October 2013, but that was just for a month. Xbox has set the standard in media center interface among the consoles to the point that XBMC, which is the Xbox Media Center, Linux distro is one of the best. I'm not sure PlayStation was ever in front of Xbox in any sales figures. Here is a knowledge base on the network device power management setting. That was in response to that. On the wireless channel question, he's responding to a whole bunch of topics, and we talked about wireless last week. You really want to use the same SID on different channels. In general use channels 1, 6, and 11, which are considered non-overlapping, newer protocols will allow for additional channels such as 1, 5, 9, 13, because they are thinner. For example, channel 1 has no low-end bleed and only interfaces with 2 and 3. Traffic on channel 6 will bleed into 4, 5, 7, 8, and 8. Channel 11 will bleed into 9, 10, and channels above. Devices should pick up the best signal on the same channel. But this isn't always the case. The setting is called roaming aggressiveness and can be Googled to get specific operating system info. Personally, my devices roam well between my two access points in my house on each end. You can download Wi-Fi Analyzer on Android phones to see where signal is strongest in your home. You'll also be able to see how your channels are non-overlapping. This reason to do this is simple. seamless roaming among access points. I would never want to have a business client have to switch Wi-Fi networks on their phone and laptop if they move from their office to another end of the building. I wouldn't want to do it at home either. Love the show, Brandon. When I configured wireless access in a big office or a big company, I would use a solution like Aruba, where it's seamless between all the access points and you have a controller back in the data center that all the access points connect to and phone home to, and you can manage the security on all the access points. So it depends on how big of a solution we're talking about. The big solutions I find easier to roll out something like Aruba and their controller. The home and small office, that's when it gets tough. And I'm going to take a look at some of the suggestions here that Brandon's mentioned, which is trying different channels, having the same SID. But let's continue. We got some really good feedback on this topic. And this is from Brad, and this is about home wireless. It's Brad, and he is from Alberta, Canada. On your latest show, you were talking about multiple SIDs in your house based on the floor the router is on. I have a possible solution for you. The first is how my house is set up. I bought a few access points from open-mesh.com. They are designed to work as a mesh network, a step above a repeater, providing a single SID and authentication from all access points. The access points are very affordable and easy to configure and manage with their free cloud controller. My APs also support PoE, which is power over Ethernet, so that they can be placed in the ideal locations. You can also get nice indoor wall plug enclosures so they are not an eyesore in a hallway. And he has a link from that from Open Mesh. The other option, if you do not want to buy new hardware, is to flash your current router's firmware with DDWRT, an alternative firmware, and all can give features such as meshing or turning them into repeaters. So it looks like the terminology we want to focus on is meshing, M-E-S-H-I-N-G, the meshing of the access points, so we can have seamless access in an area, so we don't have to change the Wi-Fi access point depending on what floor we're on. And that's what people do in my house. Okay, we're going to change gears here a little bit. This is a question from David, and he sent me this quite a while back. He asked me and Carrie this question, but I wanted to deal with it here. Can you do a segment on buying a server? Can you take me through the process from when a customer calls to the server being set up on site, verifying their hardware, software, and current issues, employee growth and recommended system configuration from software vendors? What are the questions you ask to determine what the customer needs? Can you also customize a server on Dell's site and give an explanation of each option? I selected this tower case today. It supports X many 3.5, all the specs. I always use RAID 1. How do you determine that you're buying enough hardware to support the load? David, this little email, David, that you asked would take 20 years to answer. You're asking, well, actually 30 years I've been in the business. You're asking for the accumulated knowledge that I've earned throughout my whole life to be able to address all of your questions. It's impossible to answer on a short podcast. Not going to happen. You're going to have to take some matters into your own hands. You're going to have to do some research and some learning. I'm going to help you on picking a server, though, based on the needs of a client. And it's tricky. It's very, very hard. What you need to do is take a look at what are they trying to accomplish? What are their needs? Are they hosting applications? Are they hosting a database? And then if they are, what would you be able to do for their security? What are they looking for? How big of a company? How many people are going to be accessing it? This is where you got to do some due diligence with the individual applications, and it varies. For example, let's say it's a dental office, it's an orthodontist, and they have software for their whole business that they're hosting, and it's a database that's behind it. It's a SQL database. You need to contact the manufacturer and get the specs of the hardware that they recommend. And most software manufacturers are very good at sizing the hardware. They'll tell you, well, if he has this many clients and this many users accessing it, then you need this size processor. You need this size of a server in order to serve it up. So as you can see where it gets very complicated, you have to have extensive network knowledge, security knowledge. You need to understand the server operating system. There's no way you're going to be able to buy a server, sell it, and install it to a company if you've never seen Windows Server 2012 or 2008, depending on what operating system it's going to be installed. And they're your choices. It's 2008 R2. Or it's Windows Server 2012 Standard or Windows Server 2012 Essentials. There are differences for each of those operating systems. So I'm trying to give you a very high level look down at what this process is. And you need to have an understanding of the server operating systems before you dare try to sell a server. Now, if you have an opportunity that you don't want to lose, the best advice I could give you is partnering with someone that can mentor you and help you through the process. I offer that as a service for my consulting if you want that. But I would recommend someone that's nearby that can help you. A person, and you may not know someone near you, but that is experience with servers, will need to guide you on helping you recommend the right one. It's not just picking a computer and then picking its components. You need to have an understanding of the operations of the business and what their needs are and what their growth is. You're going to have to look at storage. As a minimum, right now, with today's operating systems, I would not get less than 16 gig of RAM. I would not get less than 3 terabytes of available space. That would be 4 1-terabyte drives in a RAID 5 scenario. That's my minimum configuration right now. You need a backup solution. A backup solution that not only backs up the whole server, but also takes into account the applications that are running on it. Are you replacing existing applications? Are you replacing an existing domain where you may have to go through a domain migration? Now it gets really complicated. So you can see how this little question spawns multiple. You know, I have hundreds of more questions than I do answers. That's what I want to provoke here on getting you to think of just how deep, how detailed this is in order for you to be able to answer it. And that's why I've taken so long to address this question, because it's just so complex. And the best thing is, so I know what everybody's saying, well, Mike, how do I get experience with that? Well, you know what? My best recommendation, I'm going to say again, is you got to partner with someone that's done it. And you tell them, look, I'm going to help you with this opportunity here, but in return, I want you to help me understand the process of getting this done and partnering with someone. So this way you don't lose the opportunity and you gain the experience. I think that's my most productive recommendation for you if you aren't sure of how to handle this. Next question. This is from another David. Online backup solution recommendations. Hi, Mike. First, let me say I'm a massive fan of your podcast, both Tech Vets and The Mike Tech Show. After listening to your recent shows, I'm getting round to addressing my backup requirements. I'm in the UK and currently backup online to Dropbox. Can you recommend a monthly paid service that I could back up my Mac and NAS to? I'm keen to get some off-site backup in place. Thanks, and I really appreciate your advice. Please keep up the good work, and it is thoroughly enjoyed. Kind regards, David. David, I'm going to give you my single recommendation. There's lots of places out there, but I have had most success right now with my small businesses. Actually, two I'm going to recommend. Mosey Pro and Envelock. So Mosey Pro or Envelock, Envelock. This next question is from Mike. I'm in the process of moving our Active Directory environment off of Windows 2000 server to a new Windows 2008 R2 server. I have prepped our Windows 2000 domain and upgraded the schema so that I could add the domain controller role to the Windows 2008 server. Okay, cool. I can replicate changes between the two servers, but I'm having an issue replicating the sysvol directory to the new Windows 2008 server. I have tried forcing replication by stopping the NTFS and netlogon services and setting the D4 and D2 flags in the registry on the appropriate servers and restarting both of those services. The sysvol and netlogon network shares are both present on the Windows 2008 server. We are using Bind 9 for our internal DNS, but both of the servers have DNS running on them. The Windows 2000 server points to Bind 9 server for primary and itself for secondary. The Windows 2008 server points to the same Bind 9 server for primary and itself for secondary. Also note, I did not move any of the schema roles over to the Windows 2008 R2 server. I'm wondering if you got to move the FISMO roles, and we're getting really geeky here, technical. You might have to move all of the FISMO roles to the Windows 2008 R2 domain controller. I don't like the fact that that box is not your primary DNS. I would feel better. Now, I'm not a Bind guy, so I don't know Bind 9, and I'm wondering if you should make your Windows 2008 R2 server the primary DNS and have the Bind 9 as your secondary. When I run DC Diag on the Windows 2008 server, all tests pass and I only get errors that there are issues in the event log that have to do with the group policies. The processing of group policy failed. Windows attempted to read the file. He has the event ID. Any suggestions would be greatly appreciated. Mike, you know, when you're in an Active Directory environment, I always look, when in doubt, look to DNS. And I think you're on the right track here. I'll take a look at the articles that you reference here and get back to you. If anybody else that has a network administration experience here and domain migration experience, let me know if there's other things that Mike can try. But Mike, check the FISMO roles on the main domain controller, and then I would make that the primary DNS and see what happens. Now, Home Tech PC also said, and then demote the 2000 server, which I recommend. You want to get away from the 2000 server, so this way you are Windows 2008 Active Directory. I also agree with that. And make the 2000 server just a member server. Let me know if this helps. This is from Tony, and this is Spam Soap. It's about, hello, Mike. We use Spam Soap with some of our customers to provide spam and virus protections for their email. A customer would point their MX record to the Spam Soap servers. Spam Soap scrubs the emails and forwards them to the customer's Exchange server. It does a great job of spam filtering and virus protection of a company's emails, but also provides a spoofing service. Spam Soap constantly monitors the connection to the Exchange server, and if there is an outage, it will spoof all of the email until a connection is reestablished. This is a great option when a customer's server goes down or they lose internet connection. Their customers will not receive bounce backs. You set up individual accounts so customers have the ability to access those emails when their server or an internet connection is down. Example, they can access the spooled emails from their home computers. They also offer mail archiving up to 7 years. That's pretty cool. Encryption services and outbound filtering. That's great. What I like about the cloud service is that you are not going to take up resources on a customer server. The cost is around $3 per month for the basic package. They offer a reseller program, and best of all, they have great help desk and have many online training videos. Like you have said, you need many tools to protect yourself from the bad guys, and Spam Soap is just one of the tools we use. We also use Nod32, and it does a great job on customers' desktops and servers. Hope this information is useful, and I'm looking forward to your feedback. Tony, thank you very much. You described exactly what the Postini service used to be and the McAfee spam filtering, virus filtering for email service currently provides. And this Spam Soap looks like another product that we should take a look at when you want to filter email in the cloud before it comes to your server. I'm a big fan of that for blocking spam and blocking viruses that are part of email. And I am not in favor of running those utilities on your network. They kill the performance of your Exchange server. And I've seen this over and over. These are services that you want to move to the cloud in front of your network so you can gain more performance on your server if you're hosting email for yourself or for your client. This is a good recommendation, Tony. Thank you very, very much. This is from Nancy. Office 2013 and Integrated Office EXE, the installation for MS Office 2013 is a bit different from previous models. This one downloads the basic downloader and brings in the rest of the package during install. What's cool about that is that it can be run well before the full install is complete. The downside is for those of us that are bandwidth challenged is that the installation happens over the air instead of locally. Additionally, when there are updates, an executable runs called integratedoffice.exe and it will suck up some data. I no longer have the option to notify me when the updates are available for Office, the way I do with Windows. With Office 2013, there are two options, fully automatic or fully manual, meaning I have to go and manually check for updates, and the updates so far have been pretty big. I'm hoping that's the only implementation of integratedoffice.exe because it doesn't take much to bust through my limit. Nancy, thank you, and thank you for the warning on that. I'm very fortunate. The Office 2013 that I've installed has come on a DVD download from my TechNet subscription, which I know next year it's going away. I'm going to miss that. But I have not bought the retail version, but I've had clients. I have experienced exactly what you're talking about. I have a client that is technically challenged and had to have Windows 8 when it came out, had to have Office 2013, and it's just been a nightmare for me. That was, if you recall, the syncing of the contacts and the problems I was having with Google Apps. Well, that's the one client who happens to be the owner of the business and wants to be on the bleeding edge of technology. But luckily, he understands the pitfalls of being on the bleeding edge. And he said, Mike, I know it's not your fault, and I demand it that I won it, Office 2013 and Windows 8 when it came out. So it's nice having a client that recognizes this, and he knows there's going to be some issues. Even when he gets frustrated, he knows it's not my fault, calls on me to help him out, and that works out. This week in the U.S., we're celebrating Thanksgiving Day on Thursday, and I want to wish everybody a happy and safe Thanksgiving Day holiday. I also want to thank everybody for using my Amazon link, and that's amazon.mikenation.net. You've made November 2013 the single greatest month that I've ever had as an affiliate for that. And it's because of you, and I thank you. I want to thank everybody for your support over the years, your kindness, your generosity, being there, helping me out along the way. It's been 9 years I've been doing this, and I thank everybody. I have a lot of listeners that are not in the States. I know we celebrate Thanksgiving Day here in the U.S. Take a moment, everybody, wherever you're at, and give thanks to your family, your friends. Take a look at the positives no matter what's going on in your life. Take a look at what's happening that's positive and focus on that and be thankful for what you have. And I really sincerely thank you for being part of the Mike Tech Show family. The next show will be Thursday, December 12th. That's the next live show. There'll be no show next week. Have a great, safe, and happy holiday. I will see you next time, same time, Thursday night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.